Dr. Razak is a professor of sociology and equity studies in education at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto. And her area of research focuses on race and gender in the law. Her most recent book, Casting Out, The Eviction of Muslims from Western Law and Politics, was just published by the University of Toronto Press. Shireen is one of the leading thinkers in this country on critical race feminist theory, and I'm very, very happy to welcome her here. Shireen.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm very intimidated. So Sunera told me I'd be speaking to a few people in a small room. So I would like to thank Sunera for consistently, over so many years, providing these kinds of spaces where we can have this kind of discussion. I would like to thank her also for leading these kinds of discussions and inspiring us across Canada. So it's an honor to be part of it. I recognize some of you here, and I know that I've come here before, again, with events that Sunera has facilitated. So thank you. It's my fault that it says 4 years after Amore, because I wrote that a year ago. When those photos were released, it was April of 2004, and in that very same month, my book was released on the Somalia affair. And this was unbelievable to me, because when I saw the Abu Ghraib photos, I realized that this was intensely familiar. Sexualized violence, photos, militaries. So we had our own Abu Ghraib well before. So like all of you in this room, I imagine, what you remember about 2004, if you took note of Abu Ghraib, was that you remembered the photos, and you remembered the sex, and you probably also remembered, some of you, especially the feminists in the room, would have remembered that they included women participating in the torture. So that's what we remember. For me, the shock was that this is what peacekeeping violence is about as well. It's collective. Lots of people know it's going on. It's recorded. Lots of photos, lots of videos. People record it in their diaries and so on. It's sexualized. And it's committed against prisoners and other defenseless populations. So peacekeeping violence shared this with Abu Ghraib. The other thing that it shared with Abu Ghraib was the immediate production of explanations for the violence that went something like this. The troops were very stressed. They were confronting very savage populations who were out of control. In Somalia, we Canadians said, you know, it was a lawless land. We also said that really, if it's anybody's fault, it's the fault of unscrupulous leaders. So all of this was, again, disturbingly familiar, because this immediately started coming out about Abu Ghraib. I had argued then, in the first piece I wrote on Abu Ghraib, which is a chapter in my book Casting Out, I had argued that what was going on was quite clearly colonial. And I didn't actually call peacekeeping violence torture or even prisoner abuse. I just called it colonial violence. So when Abu Ghraib came out, I had to really kind of rethink this, because this was immediately being produced as torture. And so one of the first things I want to invite you to think about tonight is the story we tell about violence, what we call it, and how we explain it, says a lot. And that's basically my topic for tonight. Abu Ghraib was nevertheless uniquely shocking, even though one could connect it to colonial violence and to peacekeeping violence. And it was shocking simply because of the scope of it. I remember being on a CBC television program where Andrew Coyne of the National Post was arguing with me that it was only a few photos. This was like, I think, May. Well, we now know that there were more than 4,000 photos, and those are just the ones that people, you know, came up with and so on. So the scope of it was enormous. Scholars very quickly began pointing out that what was happening there had close links to the prison industrial complex in the U.S. Legal scholars immediately began reminding us, along with philosophy majors and other people, that this was really a Gambian state of exception, where there were people who existed in this very strange legal space where you could do anything to them and it wouldn't be a crime. Everyone noticed the exceptional brutality that was sort of normalized. People began speaking of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib as the socially dead, you know, where very few people could care about their legal status. Some people, myself included, spoke of the racism that underpinned this. Avery Gordon said something that I think summed it all up. Racism determines not only who becomes a prisoner, but what the prisoner becomes, which is an inferior race, you know, which I think sort of captures it. I tried to explore in casting out the psychic underpinnings of this kind of violence. It clearly, to me, it was a colonial fantasy enacted on the bodies of Iraqis. The soldiers turned their prisoners into sexually violated and brutalized men and women, and they kept the moment alive through the act of taking the photo. You could return to it again and again and again. So tonight I want to talk about how Abu Ghraib is remembered. And I particularly want to talk about it now, 5.5 years later, because with the election of Obama, there is a lot of talk that we're possibly in a post-torture era, and maybe all the terrible things that happened under George Bush will now stop. And there's a lot of, Obama himself has announced that America does not torture. So, although I will focus tonight on what might sound like an American story, I want to point out two things about that. One is that we are all in the American story in this age of empire. But the second thing is that we have a Canadian story that closely corresponds. And that's kind of the second installment on this piece of research. So, you know, we have our tortured populations. And although we say we have not participated directly in torture, I leave it up to you to think about the morality of facilitating torture or making it possible or knowing about it and not doing anything about it. So we have Maher Arar, Almaty, Almalki, Abdul Razak. You know, we have a list. Currently, for instance, last week's newspaper promoted that, you know, we have known about the prisoner exchanges in Afghanistan where people were tortured. So the story of torture is ours very intimately as a nation, but I won't be talking about that tonight. But it bears thinking that what we have seen in Canada in the last few years is a very persistent abandonment of racialized Canadians. There's a long list of people, either abandoned in Kenya and can't come home because they can't prove their identities, abandoned in Sudan where they're tortured, and so on and so on. We have a very long list of those people. And I think it is important to connect torture, which is after all sort of a dramatic instance of abandonment, to all these other moments of abandonment, many of which involve torture. So that's interesting. Finally, just as a preliminary, for many of us in this room, when we saw those pictures at Abu Ghraib, we saw possibly our brothers, our fathers, our sons. And the impetus for me wanting to talk about this is that I think that narratives about torture tell us something about which lives are considered worthwhile. Lives, whose lives are considered important? What is the function of marking certain bodies as lives that are less important? And I want to stress that for those of us that noticed the resemblance between who was being tortured at Abu Ghraib and our brothers, cousins, and so on, It is not just a racial resemblance that is at issue. For many of us, what we noticed is that we were all getting put into a moral category, and it was not a good place to be. And I think I wanted to just say at the outset that that is the impetus for trying to think about stories of torture. So Obama says the United States doesn't torture. Are we really in a post-torture age? Well, the first thing to remember, and I'm going to quote Michael Tosig on this, most of us know and fear torture and the culture of terror only through the words of others. So Tosig said, you know, my concern then is with the mediation of terror through narration and with the problem of writing effectively or speaking effectively against torture, because torture for so many of us is a narrative. So we have got to pay attention to how that narrative works, and that's my focus. So in this post-torture age, as was said in the introduction, no one above the rank of sergeant has yet been punished. So we need to think seriously about that. Can we actually be post-torture if there is so little accountability for torture? And more importantly, can we be post-torture if we're not post-empire? So the ghosts of Abu Ghraib return to haunt us in uncanny ways, reminding us that the imprinting of power on their bodies, because that's what torture is really a central way in which empire, which is abstract, becomes something concrete and embodied. So this reflection on, 4 years since, 5 years since, really began for me when I thought about how do you recognize empire operating in talk about torture? And you recognize empire wherever you hear that a superior civilization is forced to defend its values from barbarians through annihilating them, torturing them, etc. So whether pro or con, torture talk that invokes the idea that we now have a savage, especially culturally different enemy from whom we must defend ourselves in uncharacteristic ways, that is torture talk, that is empire talk, because what is being invoked are two kinds of people, one of whom it is permissible to violate with impunity. You know, again, people who study colonialism have reminded us of this a long time ago. Michael Tosig says, you know, really what lies at the heart of a contest that is imagined as one between savagery and civility? What that is race. It's a racial divide, two levels of humanity. I also need to say at the outset that obviously I'm not following the line of thinking that considers torture to have some kind of instrumental value, that people torture because they want information, for instance. That I'm actually thinking and proposing that we must understand torture as literally writing on the body the power that you're expressing. As scholars of colonialism have pointed out, Marnia Lazric for Algeria, what you have in torture is a battle between two embodied realities, in her case, colonial France and Algeria, and that's what you have going on the body of the person being tortured. So torture actually links the body to the state, because through torture, we become socially integrated into a vision of what our society is. So in an everyday sort of mundane way, the urge to run back to my computer and write yet again on Abu Ghraib happened when I was attending a workshop that was supposedly an anti-racist workshop by a very well-known scholar whom I won't name. And there was a panel at this workshop where there was a former military interrogator, an anthropologist, a psychologist, and a philosopher. And all were discussing the justification for new methods of interrogation. And the justification that they were discussing is that we are now facing, we in the West, are now facing a culturally different enemy. The Arab enemy, all of these learned academics said, is more ideologically driven and more religious. And furthermore, clandestine. You might stop a minute and think about which enemy is not clandestine, which enemy is not ideologically driven, but let's not harp on small details. The fact is that this was a very respectable setting in which people were discussing that possibly torture can be justified by virtue of the fact that we now have this very unusual enemy. As Stephen Holmes explained, I think this put it very succinctly, the logic behind torture is really a very simple one. To respond to the savages who want to kill us, we must cast off our Christian liberal meekness and embrace a healthy savagery of our own. So, you know, that is really the logic. You might recall, some of you, this kind of culture talk when Abu Ghraib first hit the media. You might remember, for instance, people saying, mostly the military, but an amazing number of journalists picked up this line, the idea that sexualized torture was simply a culturally specific interrogation method. Do you remember that? It fit very nicely in with the clash of civilizations thesis. You know, the idea that because of this clash between the West and the non-West, you know, clash in values and all of that, that pyramids of naked men forced to simulate having sex with each other was everywhere to be understood as nothing more than a contemporary form of interrogation. Very few in the media then questioned the Orientalist underpinnings of this kind of claim. You know, the idea that unlike us, they are sexually repressed, homophobic, and misogynist, and so they will crack in sexualized situations, so that's why we do it. Now, this clash of civilizations approach, which I know many of you in this room, when you first heard it, would have just said, what, are they kidding? But in fact, this received a lot of play. Through the idea of cultural difference, sexualized torture became something much more generic. It became torture for the purpose of eliciting information, and ultimately it became not torture at all, just an interrogation method. And a very well-known journalist, I wonder sometimes if they feel a little ashamed for having jumped on that bandwagon then. Mark Dana, for instance, who says a different thing these days, he said at the time, well, you know, the photos are really like staged operas of fabricated shame. What we really intended with these photos was to intensify the prisoner's guilt feelings, increase his anxiety, and so his urge to cooperate. So there's a kind of, you know, instrumental use given to it. But of course, if you're going to go along this line of a culturally different enemy, you're very quickly in the domain where Americans are marked as modern people who don't subscribe to puritanical notions of sex or to patriarchal notions of women's role. The Iraqis, of course, are exactly the opposite. And in this kind of culturally specific explanations, torture actually drops out of the picture. Now, that kind of culture talk does still persist. It persists, for example, in sort of well-known right-wing spaces like Fox News, where you can hear journalists like Heather McDonald saying, the Islamist enemy is unlike any the military has ever encountered. They don't give up information. They don't play by the rules of the Geneva Convention. Interesting that she should say that because someone else doesn't play by the rules of the Geneva Convention as well. And they're mainly interested in homosexual sex. That's Heather McDonald, Fox News. So confronted with this kind of uncivilized enemy, Americans had no choice but to turn to various stress techniques, some of which she acknowledges may have gone a bit too far. She doesn't like the idea of dogs, and she's a little concerned about waterboarding. But on the whole, her conclusion is, what could we do in this situation? And at least we don't gas people like the Nazis did. That's a very interesting thing to have crept into the conversation. Now, academics contribute to this in interesting ways. So you get academics who are and I, you know, can give you the names and footnotes after if you want them. But you say you have academics who talk about the mortification of Iraqi soldiers, not the torture, but the mortification. You have academics who defend a legally authorized bending of the rules. You have academics, you know, you have the Alan Dershowitzes of the world who say, well, we should really have a system of torture warrants where you can apply for permission to torture people who are of especially high value and presumably who are especially savage. So, you know, some people just have to be tortured. What can you do? The story you tell of torture, as I said, is productive. It's not innocent. As I think Elaine Scarry pointed this out many, many years ago, 40 years ago or something, 30 years ago now. If you call torture an interrogation, this is a productive fiction that stops the pain from penetrating your consciousness. The story actually does that for you. And I think that that is a very important point. But today, 5.5 years later, if you're actually tracking this sort of thing and you're willing to put Fox News in a special category, what you really find is that there are, in fact, many people who are condemning torture these days. It cannot be said that there are no voices condemning torture. There are people condemning torture. And so what I want to think about are those people and their relationship to the people that talk this culturally different line. So, on the whole, Americans have engaged in a public discussion about the meaning of Abu Ghraib. I wonder sometimes, do you think we have engaged in a public discussion about the meaning of Maher Arar's experience? I don't know, but Americans have engaged in this, and in many sites, they have actually done so as critics. And there's been an enormous amount of cultural production around this, films, popular ones like Rendition, but also documentaries, and the one that I will speak about tonight, Standard Operating Procedure, is by a very well-known documentary filmmaker, Errol Morris, who did Fog of War and so on. So they have really engaged in it a lot. Most of these critics, the vast majority, have engaged on the issue of torture by focusing on the corruption and illegality that characterized the Bush regime. That is the line of thinking. There's also been a lot of information about torture. We all know the techniques, for example. Strangely, and what I'm going to propose tonight, is that we know a lot about torture, and we know a lot about unscrupulous leaders, but it's torture without torturers. And that's a very significant omission in my view, because that is a very productive thing. And I want to talk about what does that produce. On the very rare occasions that the question is actually taken up, what made it so easy for American soldiers to be torturers? They're never called torturers, so I shouldn't even ask that. What made it so easy for them to do whatever it is they did at Abu Ghraib or are doing elsewhere, what enabled torture and so on, that too has been met with a fairly standard answer. And some of you will already guess the answer because you will have heard this on CBC shows and on films and so on. And the answer, quoting Stanley Milgram again and again and again, the experiments at Stanford, the idea that once you create a torture culture, ordinary people find it easy to torture. So, you know, the idea is pretty much Rumsfeld made them do it. Because if you have unscrupulous leaders, people will just fall in line. If torture is sort of policy, they just fall in line and do it. The problem with that, not that there aren't, you know, unscrupulous leaders, the problem with that is that they don't explore what torture is actually doing for the torturer. And a crucial part of the picture sort of drops out. We very seldom hear the voices of the tortured, of course. And recently, for instance, there's been a bit of that with the report from the Red Cross. But really, we just very seldom hear that. So when Americans propose, as Mark Danner said recently, Americans simply must confront the fact that torture is a toxic fact that's polluting our moral life. We have to figure out what this is. then they very rarely mean that we have to think about the role of these ordinary soldiers in torture. So, following many other scholars, I'm not the only person to be worried about this, what I want to ask by focusing on the ordinary people who tortured, and mostly by focusing on our response to the ordinary people who tortured, since we seem to know what our response is to Rumsfeld and company, I want to focus on how is a moral community constituted by these stories. You know, other scholars, recently Richard Wiseman himself drawing on other scholars, asked, how do the stories make us feel? And my question to you tonight is, how do the critical stories about torture make us feel? What do they make us confront? And I would argue that they turn our gaze away from the tortured themselves, and they take us a very long way from confronting the fact that some people are tortured and others are not. A routine, everyday fact of our world. So I want to suggest that the soldiers at Abu Ghraib have often aroused compassion and understanding. As a culture, North Americans appear to sympathize with many of them, perhaps believing the Milgram experiment to be a good explanation for behavior. So let us think for a minute what is produced by the story of corrupt leaders. And I want to suggest that that story, just as it did for us in Canada in the Somalia affair, that story produces a national innocence. Because it's not us who are bad. There's nothing rotten in Denmark, as Hamlet would say. It's really just a few bad men. And it's a strange time in American history. It's a time when, as the filmmaker Errol Morrow said, our children have somehow been coerced into playing Animal House on the night shift. It's an interesting way to do it. So I'm going to show some clips from the film, and then I'm going to talk about our response to these types of framings of what torture is. Before I do, I just want to make one key point about this, which is that when other people talk about torture, for instance, the Winter Soldiers, those are the soldiers who have come back from Iraq and who are now holding hearings, testifying to the awful things they were made to do, the violent things, they do not receive the same response as the torturers at Abu Ghraib. There is no sympathy for them. There's very little coverage of their acts. And they are the ones who are consistently saying what I will argue has never been said by anyone associated with Abu Ghraib: I'm sorry. And so that's very important to keep in mind. I've been debating with myself when to show these clips because they'll set you on a track. Let me just say one more preliminary thing, which is that I'm going to make a big deal of the fact that we have never heard "I'm sorry," that we have never heard an apology, we have never seen remorse from anybody associated with Abu Ghraib, anybody. But I want to remind you, as other scholars have done much better than I, Nicholas Tavouches, for instance, who's quoted by Richard Wiseman, that when you say "I'm sorry," there have to be three components. One is an unconditional acknowledgement of responsibility. The second is sincere self-condemnation. And the third is an awareness that the victim has suffered. And for Abu Ghraib, not only do we not have any of these, we have never even had a token "I'm sorry." And that is what we ought to think about when we reflect on what is the status of Muslim or Arab bodies today, post Abu Ghraib, because I think it's very important that that has never been done. And so let me show you Morris's clips from the film. I apologize in advance because somehow the voice is in out of sync with the image.
The tear, we pour cold water on them, point at him and laugh at him while he was in the shower naked, shower him with all his clothes on, cut off all his clothes with a knife, burn him with a cigarette. We just do what they want us to do.
The film also features an awful lot of the images of torture, which is a very voyeuristic gaze, and it runs very much the risk of doing what many scholars have pointed out has been done for Algeria, for instance. It trivializes the significance of torture just through the repetition of the images. But I, you know, wanted you to see their explanations for their behavior and you know, to ask you to consider whether or not you see any expressions of remorse there at all, as I feel from this and other evidence. There's actually little evidence that there was any moral conflict at all. The soldiers do not believe that they personally did anything wrong. There's an intense self-absorption in all of these narratives. Sabrina Harmon doesn't know what she could have done different. As an afterthought, she says, maybe I shouldn't have joined the military. They're mostly sorry for themselves. I'm sorry, you know, I got screwed over. A big chunk of my life is gone. Life's not fair. Lindy England announced that she wouldn't change a thing because she got her son out of it. But if self-pity runs like a stream through these narratives, and the soldiers are clearly not only not sorry for what they did to Iraqis, but barely aware of what they did to Iraqis. And they often, as the film goes on, they hover between, you know, describing what they did as humiliation and not torture, which our esteemed Michael Ignatieff does as well. It is a very gendered story, as you see from here, because each is performing, and I won't have time to go into that. But I was, you know, very intrigued by the way in which each of those soldiers described the first time that they were brought into this context and they saw prisoners stripped naked with bikini panties over their heads and so on. How do they actually account for that? And what you get is people like Lindy England saying, well, at least we didn't hit them. At least we didn't cut off their heads. You also get a kind of strange, I think in Lindy England's statement, at least we didn't kill him, at least we didn't cut off their heads. She's the shadow of that is the shadow of people who do cut off heads. So she's sort of unconsciously placing herself in a comparison with this imagined racial other. Now, you might say to yourself that these kinds of, you know, this expression of no remorse, no moral conflict, and so on, these kinds of you know, performances, if you like, where the practices of torture are described in great detail with, you know, very little evidence of even conflict. You know, we just turned on the showers. All we did was wet the detainees until it was hard for them to breathe through the hoods. You know, this kind of thing, or Sabrina Harmon is able to draw diagrams in her letters home of how they use dogs on prisoners. This sort of participation, the mundane work of torture elicits very little moral conflict. And you might say to yourself that perhaps it's understandable that torturers would exhibit those attitudes. After all, you don't want to be charged and spend even more years in the brig than you have. But then the question I would invite you to think about is, okay, so what's the excuse of the filmmakers, the critics, the consuming public of this narrative? And although I'm using one example, I can assure you of other examples of other films where the filmmaker actually is interviewed later and says things like, I really liked them. I quite liked them. They were very likable. So that's the narrative. So how do we account for the filmmaker? How do we account for the people that say Lindy England was simply a person in love who was duped by a man? How do we account for Errol Morris saying that when he looked at Sabrina Harmon, did she commit a crime? No, she didn't really commit a crime. And I think we can account for that because nowhere in this picture are tortured Iraqis. So what is in this picture if there are no tortured Iraqis in this picture? And the reviewers actually give us some clue about this. Reviewers go on and on about how lovely these soldiers are, particularly the women. Quotes are, you know, she wouldn't hurt a fly, we know she's telling the truth, and so on. Very nice sorts of things. A Canadian reviewer, Peter Goddard, said, you know, the picture of the torturer, you remember the famous one of, you know, posing like that, that's not a picture of torture, that's really a picture about Lindy England being dominated by Charles Grainer. So that's the story that we should remember, that it's about Lindy and her ill-fated relationship with Charles, and not, in fact, about the torturer. So one is really struck by this, the total absence of bodies. What body, then, is there? And if you look at, for instance, the review of Michael Chaikin, who's, you know, a very well-known novelist, Michael Chaikin says that, you know, the pictures divert our attention from that for which there is no substitute, the faces of those frightened, disoriented men and women tearfully coming to terms with historical forces of which they too are hapless victims. If you're having trouble following, because when someone reads a quote, it's very hard to follow, you might be a little disoriented here, because he's actually talking about the torturers as the hapless victims of historical forces. He's not talking about the Iraqis at all. This is a very specific moral community that is being created here. This is a moral community where, in fact, the people who count are the torturers, not the tortured. Torture has an almost built-in connection to race. I've been wondering if I should go out on a limb and say torture always has a relationship to race. Because when you're engaging in torture, you have to turn the person you're torturing into another race. What is most remarkable about these stories and this particular framing of torture is that we have a pretty coherent, full picture about the superior race. Their superiority is announced in every turn, in every frame. Torture then finds justification in the alleged barbarity of the enemy. And even when it's difficult to make the case for barbarity, as in Abu Ghraib, where even all of these soldiers, especially the last one, Jamal, actually says, you know, we picked up everybody, the baker, the butcher, everybody, we picked them all up and brought them to Abu Ghraib. The soldiers, you know, in one breath, they're very aware that they were pretty much torturing ordinary people who didn't have anything to offer. But in the other breath, they say, well, you know, it's necessary to prevent further people from getting blown up. So what I wanted to consider ultimately is the point, I think, well made by Richard Wiseman, to refuse to apologize or share remorse when it is expected may signify no less than the rejection of one moral universe in favor of another. And the moral universe that we are being offered in stories of torture, and this is especially the case, not especially the case, this is equally the case in critical stories of torture as they are in non-critical Fox News stories of torture, the moral community that we're being offered is that Iraqi bodies are not worth counting. I want to end with a last sort of example. When I began writing this paper as a story of how cultural difference is used, I was actually in Irvine, California, and an intriguing story appeared in the Los Angeles Times. This was a story of Blackwater, you know, the hired mercenaries, shooting, a Blackwater shooting where 17 Iraqis were killed. And so the headline in the LA Times, Blackwater shooting highlights a US-Iraq culture clash. Well, I, of course, was immediately intrigued on how a massacre of 17 people was actually a culture clash. And so I, you know, read on, and the journalists had you know, began quoting. So there was the son of an Iraqi man, Abdul Razak, strangely the same name, you know, noted that, you know, the Iraqis call it a massacre. Blackwater calls it a situation that arose because the workers feared for their lives, so they, you know, had to massacre in order to protect themselves. So the big story that this news article was concerned with was that Mr. Razak refused monetary compensation. And here were U.S. officials, you know, apologizing. They weren't apologizing, but they were handing out money, monetary compensation. So the reporter offered this analysis of this very strange situation where you have someone who is refusing monetary compensation. He says, far from bringing justice and closure, the investigations underline the friction between Iraqis and Americans. And it turns out that it's an unbridgeable gap. And what is the unbridgeable gap? U.S. officials painstakingly examine evidence and laws while attempting to satisfy victims' claims through each cash compensation. But unfortunately for these law-abiding people who are busy calculating compensation, traditional Arab society values honor and decorum. The perpetrator admits responsibility, commiserates with the victim, pays medical expenses all over glasses of tea in a tribal tent. And that is simply not what Americans do. So, as a former U.S. diplomat concluded, our system is so different from theirs that I don't think that they will ever accept our way and we will never accept theirs. Framed as a culture clash, the article then ends with the voice of another victim, a father of two who was severely injured and who also refused compensation. Finally, a third victim, and they're both saying the same thing. This person was a physician who lost his physician wife and his medical student son in this massacre. And he also said, I don't want your money. I don't want compensation. No amount of money will sweep this under the rug. He then added what he really wanted. He said, I want you to feel that Iraqi life is precious. It seems certain that the United States will not accept this quaint Arab custom of wanting to acknowledge that life is precious for them. Our system is indeed different to theirs. I want to suggest we are neither post-torture nor post-empire. And what these kinds of cultural explanations reveal is the perniciousness of Western refusal to grant that Iraqi life is precious. And that's where I'd like to leave it.